This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is humorist and actor Spalding Gray. He once told me that he worries he would get cancer if he kept his stories and secrets to himself. He was explaining why he confides so much to his audiences in his theater monologues, which have become his public autobiography. Reviews of his autobiographical monologues have compared Spalding Gray to Woody Allen and how they can get laughs through mining their neuroses and metaphysical doubts. Spalding Gray has been a hit in the experimental theater world for years, but until very recently, he's been virtually unknown outside it. His movie roles in The Killing Fields and David Byrne's True Stories are introducing him to wider audiences. New York Uptown audiences discovered him at Lincoln Center, where his retrospective of monologues was held over. Six of his monologues are collected in his new book, Sex and Death to the Age 14. Before the interview, we're going to hear an excerpt of Spalding Gray's latest monologue, The Terrors of Pleasure, in which he describes how he took a shot at the big time by going to L.A. to audition for high-paying TV roles. He needed the money to finance a new foundation for the country house he bought, which he just discovered was collapsing. Here's the setup. It's Spalding Gray's screen test for a made-for-TV movie. His director, Simon, and his co-star, Sandy, are both TV veterans. Spalding and Sandy are doing a take of their big love scene.
We were supposed to have just finished making love, and we are now lying naked under the blankets in front of the fire. I am supposed to get out my sketch pad and begin to sketch Dale. Simon put down a paisley spread and asked Sandy and me to get comfortable on it. The honeymoon scene went something like this. Scott, got your eyes full, honey? What are you looking at? Dale. You. Scott. What do you want? Dale. You. Scott. But you've already had me. Dale. Not enough. Never enough. Then I'm supposed to move in on her and sing, a kiss is just a kiss. In her ear, right? And we kiss and collapse in laughter. I really try to find my way into the character. I'm using my notebook as a sketch pad, and I'm holding a paperclip. I'm pretending it's a piece of charcoal. I'm just sketching away as we grow through these lines. All of a sudden, Simon yells, cut, cut, stop, stop, Spalding. The sketch pad is just a prop. Don't worry about it. You really want Dale. And I said, slightly taken aback, because I thought I was in character, oh, you mean I'm not really an artist? Because any artist would rather sketch than make love.
Well, as you may have guessed by now, Spalding Gray didn't get the role, but the role is so unlike what he does on stage, I wanted to know if he had done any roles in the past that prepared him for his TV auditions.
It was like the kind of scene work I had done in college, where I was thinking of myself then as a young romantic lead. And I was really trying to go back and play this painter that I was supposed to be, and she was supposed to be my model, New England painter. And I was very sincere, and I was not bad. I saw the video of it, and the director was supposed to send me the raw video footage, and he freaked. He was afraid that I would do something with it publicly, even though I promised I wouldn't, because he was just afraid of being exposed. But I saw those video playbacks. And a lot of what I did was very dramatic, very intense. But one of the interesting things that I noticed was that my face was totally alive, like amoebic, like protein, all moving and shifting. And my mouth was so expressive, and I'd be touching myself. And I realized that TV people know how to keep a still face so you can project the emotion on them. They are like Zen in Zen meditation. They don't, and my face was just crawling. And I thought, that would be weird on TV. It wouldn't work. I could understand why when they saw the video. It was just so expressive.
I guess it's gotten to the point now where people want you to make pledges that you won't do monologues about them and maybe make them look bad.
Well, a little bit. I remember when I was auditioning, during that run of auditions where I decided I wouldn't make any judgment, and I would try to pacify my agent by going up for everything they sent me. That mainly I was doing that when I was out performing in L.A. just about a year ago. And I just was there and was going up for everything. I was doing Swimming to Cambodia. And I remember coming into an audition that I was very good for, actually. I was supposed to play a doctor that was kind of comic. And I walked in, and the casting director just threw up her arms when she saw me, and she said, we don't want to hear any stories about this. Laugh, laugh, laugh. And then I proceed not to get the role. So there's a bit of unconscious, a very conscious blacklisting going on. I think in at least in that scene, which isn't, you know, it's not the high film scene. I'm not really yearning for TV, although it might be fun to do it. But I think they're saying, look, when you really give up this reflection, when you give up this commentary, this being a writer, and join the lowly, unconscious, wealthy actors of L.A. and be like one of them, because we are in control, then we'll give you a job.
So you're supposed to renounce your past and renounce what you've done and join
pay
their
your
ranks.
Dues. You have to pay your Hollywood dues, I think. Yeah, because my dues have been paid in a completely different area that they respect, intimidated by, but they do, that it's not their currency. Avant-garde theater, blah, blah, blah.
See, I think of you in a way as being proof of the theory that you can't just sell out. It's not that easy, that you have to have the sensibility, too. You know, that if you don't have the sensibility, you just can't sell out
that
well.
It is funny. I'm having a hard time doing it. Yeah.
I'm really not convinced that you could do well on a sitcom.
I don't think I could.
Because you do some of the lines that you had to do readings of in your monologue, and those lines are just absurd. They're just so ultra-television. I can't imagine it.
You can't help but taking off on them. Mm-hmm. You know? For me, I mean, I couldn't help but doing them ironically. I can't resist finding the humor in the situation.
So you still, I mean, it looks like you can really do this on your own terms, you know, that you could do acting and movies
terms. It always works when the directors come to me and not audition me. I'm very bad at auditions. I'm very bad under pressure. It's when the director sees when the director has the vision to see in me what they can use. Directors come and see me perform, but most of them aren't intelligent enough to be able to get the essence out of it, to extract the writing from the... You know?
Aren't you supposed to, as an actor, feel like, I'm going to get out there and I'm going to show them what I can do and almost look forward to auditions?
See, as I say in my monologue, I'm missing that go-for-it spirit, you know, that really, I'm not driven in that way.
Did this hatred of auditions and contribute to your leaving, at least temporarily leaving, acting, stage acting?
Well, I went into the Underground Theater really in 1970 when I joined the performance group. And I would say that probably the audition thing and the whole high pressure thing and the need to be a part of a group to nurture a way of working, all of those things were playing into it. But as I do say in the monologue, Terrors of Pleasure, I talk about how I would come into, I would always have the fantasy that I was the only actor up for the role. I mean, I knew I wasn't, but it was a fantasy, you know. And you come into that waiting room, and no one knows you from anyone else there when I was just starting out. And you start looking around at these people and you want to kill these other actors. You know, all of that competition comes up. And then the other side of it is, oh, God, look at that guy. You know, he could do it just as well. Or he could do it better. Or who am I? You know, what am I bringing special to this situation? And I had to go find my own specialness. And I've taken a long, circuitous route, and I'm ready to come back, and I'm ready to do films. I don't think I'm ready to do plays anymore. Theater, although I occasionally go to it, theater doesn't interest me as much as film.
Why is it?
Because film, for me, is going in and framing the real world. And theater is going into a space that refers to itself. It's a theatrical space. And I worked in theater for so long in the performing garage, in some traditional plays and in a lot of experimental plays. And I called it the windowless art house. What excited me in The Killing Fields was being out in what you would call a normal, relatively normal, natural environment, everyday plays, and watching how it's framed. And made into special time by the film.
I guess all this preoccupation with tearing down the fourth wall and everything in the theater ends up being irrelevant in movies anyway.
Yeah, right. And I've been inside a building, inside a theater for so long. It just, the whole outside thing has opened up my head in a wonderful way.
Did you ever have the urge to play Hamlet and do Chekhov, mm-hmm. do the great
mm-hmm.
roles?
Mm-hmm. Way back when I was in college and I acted in every play over 4 years at Emerson College, and I just was sure that was my life was going to be an actor. When I got out, I was going to do, I had done scenes from Hamlet, I was going to act in regional theater. And I wanted to do Chekhov. I wanted to do any. I had been in a couple of productions at the Seagull. I wouldn't want to do Astroff and Uncle Vanya. And now I've lost it. The most recent offer was to play Dr. Dorn for Larry Sacro's production of The Seagull at Birdcliff Theater with Joanne Woodward, who is playing Madame Arkadina. And it was a choice between that and playing my own work at the Goodman Theater, and I went for my own work. And I keep saying I want to get back to the stage. And I said, well, I would play Polonius if it was Spalding Gray in a plaid shirt and dungarees trying to remember Polonius's lines. You see, I have a real battle with lines. I think it's a part of my dyslexia.
Dyslexia? Memorize,
yeah,
you have
yeah.
Dyslexia?
I have mild dyslexia, and it's not as I know there are worse cases where you see where words are just abstract. But if I try to read too fast, the letters begin to bounce around, and I'll see saw as was. So I'm a slow reader, dyslexia. And therefore I digest very well. But if I can't do a cold reading in an audition, and even if I have the text in front of me, it bounces around.
It's really hard to believe because I'm not saying I distrust you or anything, but you do your performances so swiftly. I mean, you talk so quickly when you want to,
yeah.
And you have the whole thing more or less memorized, and it's staggering because it's maybe like a 90-minute or 60-minute monologue.
No,
I know you've got your notes, but you don't really look at them that much.
There's a difference between memorizing. That's an interesting point. I cannot memorize a text that someone else has written and get it right every night. I even with Sam Shepard's Tooth of Crime, the director was always taking notes on that. But I can speak my pieces, which are not memorized, but I'm seeing a film. When I'm telling those stories, I am clearly seeing the film of those stories. So I'm really describing what's coming into my mind. If it had to be memorized, I couldn't do it.
So you don't have to get it word for word, and no one's got to follow, you know, get their cue from you.
Well,
so that
it.
They can
the
say
pressure's not on me. I don't function well under pressure. That's part of why I'm not out there grabbing the big film roles.
In fleshing out your on-stage Spalding Gray character, has that brought you in touch with different parts of yourself that were maybe not very developed before?
The humor, definitely. I really got my sense of humor when I came to New York City. And that was a combination of you've got to laugh to be in that place. And the other was being exposed to Judaism on a large scale like that. And finally having
that was
a
funny,
Jewish
huh?
girlfriend.
Oh.
No, that wasn't funny. They have a great sense of humor. And they're very extroverted. And I had grown up with introverted WASPs who have this very dry sense of humor, which is a sense of humor. I'm not saying that it's not there. But there was a certain broadness that I discovered through being in New York and being exposed to that in people. And so there's that. And the other thing that I have been able to do is to travel and to be alone now that I'm a writer, or now that I know that it can be material. And before, I really used to disappear a lot, just feeling very anxious about being in a place where no one recognized me. And since I've been learned how to take notes, there's an aspect of me, the writer, that recognizes the person, Spalding Gray. There's a very clear schism now, where I'm always watching my life for experiences that can be used, and sometimes creating the experiences, which I make a joke about in the monologue, where I say, uh-oh, did I buy this house in order to make this monologue? Because now it's come full circle. I was in Cambridge performing last year, and a woman who's reviewing a very academic book on postmodern theater, Ellie Fuchs, who's a freelance writer for The Village Voice, has a grant up there, and she's studying Cambridge. And she said, you know, I thought I couldn't include you in my book. And now I've seen your monologue about the house, and I now know that you're a postmodernist writer in this sense. And she had, it's all theoretical, right? There's some a French semiotic philosopher who says that the sign of postmodernism is that the act, the map of the act exists before the event. He uses nuclear war as an example to say that we know where the nuclear war is going to be fought. It's all on computer. And this is a postmodern condition. And she said, you bought that house in order to make the monologue. Therefore, you're a postmodernist. And now you can be in my book.
So you're going to be in it. So does this mean that before you came to New York, you were a very kind of like serious artist, that you weren't funny?
Yeah. No sense of humor at all. No sense of humor. In fact, I can remember an old girlfriend that I had. She had been a girlfriend at Emerson College, and then she came to visit me in New York after I'd been living there for about 2 years. And a bunch of us were sitting around, and she was just seeing me for the first time in a long time. And afterwards, she said, "I didn't know you were funny. You were funny. You were making me laugh. You were never funny when I knew you. What happened?" No, that was really heavy. Really. Oh, God. When I was at Emerson College, I would go to sleep at 10 o'clock every night listening to Dylan Thomas read Fern Hill. That would be my tranquilizer.
I mean, how do you get to be funny? I understand what exposed you to humor and everything, but I always think of humor as being something you're either, you know, born with or not in a way. It's not something that you can... The deadliest people are the people who decide, well, I think I ought to add a little humor to my life.
You know, I think it was there with me. And I think it went underground when it was there with me in high school. I was a real clown, cutting up a lot, blah, blah, blah. But I think it went underground during that heavy puberty time. And it was just, I turned into this really kind of existentially death-obsessed poet in college with just morbid.
Was that really good for getting girls, by the way?
No, it wasn't.
It wasn't, really?
No. I was really, truly disturbed. I didn't have many girlfriends in college, not until my senior year. No, I was into suffering. I was really into suffering, and I lived in an alley because I took the cheapest apartment I could find, you know, to help my father out, and I was working as the janitor there, and it was $35 a month because I was emptying trash, and this alley was filled with rats in Boston because they have these, and you could only enter into the apartment from the alley. We called it Rat Alley, and no one would come to visit me. You can imagine a girl coming there in any hour. At night, I'd have to come home clapping my hands. Then the rats would scurry out of the way. No kidding. I was like Edgar Allan Poe, morbid. And, you know, I had to enter into my apartment directly from the street, which meant there was no entranceway. A rat could have scurried right in there. So I didn't have any girlfriends, freshman, sophomore. I mean, it was Emerson College. Most of them were Jewish women up from New York who were into musical comedy and laughs. I mean, I was playing the wrong role. If I had been at Harvard and was acting that way, maybe it would have been different.
You know, one of the things that you really use your humor for so well is describing your own neuroses, which happens to be similar to neuroses that a lot of us have. And it makes it seem, it's so effortless and everything when you're on stage, and it makes it seem like, wow, neuroses aren't that bad. They're really pretty funny. And in fact, they're not funny to have them at all. It's funny to describe them when you're funny at it.
Mm-hmm.
But do your like problems ever strike you as being funny at the time?
No, they don't. It's not an overly painful situation, but it's an annoying situation because it's a repeat of. It gets boring because it's a repeat. The same neuroses keep coming back, and you get bored with it, and you think, now wait a minute, can I? You know, it's going to be a point where I just can't turn these into monologues any longer. Oh, maybe you can. Woody Allen's able to do one a year, you know, a film a year. I should be able to do a monologue a year if you have enough variety and setting and change it. But I think, you know, for instance, one of my problems is like taking a vacation, the neurosis about the vacation, and being able to just unwind and do nothing. And I did a little journalism in Australia and earned some extra money and decided I had always wanted to go to Bali, and I was going to go there and I was going to relax. And I got there and I started freaking out the first couple of days I was there. And then three people recognized me on the street of Ubud when I was in the art center. And so they were kind of leading me into this art community there. And I was starting to touch down, you know, finding myself in the landscape. And I got relaxed after about 5 days. And I said, now I'm going to go a little bit further. I saw all these people on motorcycles. You know, I said, I am going to rent a motorcycle and take a trip, a pleasurable trip up to this beautiful beach on the East Coast. Now I'm going to go a little bit further, and I got real nervous about all of this. I mean, it was a chaotic day, you know, because I could feel the neurosis coming on. And to avoid drinking a lot, I'd been going a cocktail hour. Every cocktail hour, I go to a Balinese healer, a Balian, who was the most wonderful man who was laughing all the time at me. He thought, because originally I went there and told him I was in three places at once, and he said he had never had anyone come in with that disease. Maybe I should get a shot, you know, of something. He wanted to send me away. Then he got out these magical drawings to describe. Grandfather had done a pencil drawing. drawings. And we went through it to try to find a drawing that would fit my condition. So we get out this beautiful drawing of this guy with no head and four legs, and his eyes are in his chest. So the healer does a mantra about that, you know, and does a copy of it for me. He copies it. And I have to have this picture over my bed. Then I told him that I thought part of why I couldn't take a vacation and why I was so riled up was because my mother committed suicide when I was taking a vacation in Mexico, you know, in the summer, and that this is coming back on me. It was kind of Freudian theory. Oh, yes, he understood this. Now, he spoke very little English, but he understood what I was saying. And he did a whole ceremony for my mother's spirit, and we picked out a drawing for her, and he was going to lay her spirit to rest. His wife made an offering and the whole thing, you know, and he did a mantra. It was very powerful for me. And then I ate the offering and I thought, now I've got a drawing that says total protection. My mother's spirit is laid to rest. I'm going to take this motorcycle, you know, up to this beach and I'm going to have a good time, right? And he told me the day to travel on. By the way, he got down the Balinese calendar. Now, it took me so long to get the motorcycle together and to get everything going that I could tell night was coming on. It was a two-hour trip up to this beach. And I thought, now maybe I should travel tomorrow when I'm fresh, you know. And he said, no, he said it was a bad day to travel tomorrow. I've got to go today. So I'm off, and it's a great trip, and everything is fine. But night falls in those countries near the equator, like just there. And it's been 98 degrees, and all of a sudden it's night, and I'm riding in a kind of damp T-shirt and shorts on this motorcycle, and I can feel this cold coming on. I mean, it came on within a minute, you know, and I ended up with this unbelievable head cold on this most idyllic beach, you know. So I knew it was subconscious. I couldn't even get a hold of that. You know, that was the angering part. I had everything consciously worked out, you know. Oh, God, that was so, I lay on that beach so depressed, and it was so idyllic, and it was so beautiful. Of course, beauty terrifies me.
You'll never be that prepared for a vacation again.
I know, everything. I mean, exactly. It was, everything was pointed toward ecstasy. Everything.
So what's holding you back from letting go and enjoying yourself?
We don't know, do we? Because that unconscious let the cold in. Imagine catching a cold in Bali, come on. At 98 degrees, a head cold. It's like a nightmare. Feel like you have a fever all the time.
You know, I think that there's a real fine line when you're on stage between revealing things about yourself and having people just laughing hysterically and thinking, oh, God, I'm like that too. God, that's so funny. Aren't we absurd? And people thinking, oh, the poor guy.
Right,
you know,
right.
he just can't relax and have a good time. That's really pathetic. I feel sorry for him.
Right.
Did it ever happen to you that in doing a monologue and instead of the kind of hysterical response that somebody... started feeling sorry for you, really?
It happened a lot. I won't say they were feeling sorry for me, but one thing I realized touring Australia as soon as I got out of Sydney was that my monologues are all built in front of a New York audience. Therefore, the humor is a New York sensibility. You know, it's about that irony. It's about playing off universes. Well, Sydney, Australia, picked up on most of that. I got to Melbourne next. Of course, Melbourne will not like anything that Sydney likes, so they'll read the reviews just to make sure. If they got a good review, they won't like it. This is competition between the two cities. In fact, someone told me when I first got there, they said the difference between Melbourne and Sydney is if someone in Melbourne has an idea, they publish it. If someone in Sydney has an idea, they throw a party. And that really typifies the two places. I got to Melbourne, and those people were so serious. And I felt like I was in Bergman's film, The Wild Strawberries, when the guy's being judged by all of those cutout in the nightmare. And I'm thinking, my God, I've got to go back into therapy. My life is a mess. Look, because it's all about the relationship between me and the audience. They're looking at me like... So Melbourne, they thought they were laughing a lot because they had nothing to compare it to. Then I went to Tasmania. Then I went to Perth, which is the most distant, isolated city in the world. And in Perth, they were silent. Silent. I would play that thing. I would just, you know, luckily Renee was there. I would play it. I would go home. I would drink a couple of Cooper's Ales and watch TV and go to bed and just say, this is a job. Go to the beach in the day. It was scary. It was scary. It was weird. I'm not saying they weren't listening. I'm sure they were getting something from it, but I don't know what.
But you were more like this weird specimen on stage, probably.
Yeah, I think so.
Than
this
someone
crazy
telling us
American.
About us.
Look
yeah.
at this American. And I would have people write me letters, actually. When I left Sydney, letters would catch up with me saying, stop pouring salt on your wounds. Do Vipassana meditation. It just takes 10 days, you know. I'm not a proselytizer. There were more people that tried to help me in Australia than anywhere else. They were nice. They were genuine. But everyone had a different therapy that they thought I should go into. And you know, I'm not denying it. I would like to go to one of these Vipassana meditation retreats. But bottom line for me is humor. Bottom line for me. And I just know I would end up making, you know, if I had the togetherness and I had the afterlife, I'd end up making fun of death. You know, if I had a proper medium to come back. But that's the only one I know I'm not going to have a comment on.
One of the things that's held together a lot of your monologues is an obsession with the perfect moment, with finding the perfect moment. Where does that come from? When did you first start wanting the perfect moment?
See, I always wanted it and didn't know. I didn't have a name for it. In fact, both my older brother and I both have had cravings for that, particularly Rocky, my older brother. And I don't know what it came from. Something to do with the relationship to my mother, who was constantly questing for ecstatic states. She was very concerned with that. And I've always been concerned with all mood changes. My ally is alcohol. That produces the mood change that I feel best with. And I have to be very careful with it because it's an ally. I don't want it to work against me. When I first conceived of the word was reading when I first adopted the word was reading a book on Sartre's works. It was an analysis of nausea, and they kept referring to Sartre's idea of the perfect moment being the bourgeois concept of when the bourgeois or ego gets in a place where everything seems to revolve around it is the perfect moment, when raw, indifferent nature coincides with the human ego. And the imperfect moment could also be a perfect moment. I mean, to lose that ego, which I've also experienced, and that is another perfect moment. But usually it's when all the elements agree with you.
Have you had any?
And have I? Oh, yeah. I talk about it in swimming to Cambodia in the Indian Ocean. When I was doing Killing Fields, you know, when I just melded with the ocean, it was very beautiful. I've had some near-perfect ones in Australia, but, you know, my brother Rocky is looking for them, and I can remember he married late, and his wife is one of those really, she had been married before, really down-to-earth Jewish mother types, and he came home from, he teaches at a boys' school, and he came home one day and went, "Oh, God, I haven't had an ecstatic moment in days." And she said, "What? What did you say? An ecstatic woman? How many of those do you expect to have in a lifetime?" She just laid into him, you know. And the two of us are always going around like that, you know, just dreaming, like, when's it going to come next? I don't know what that has to do with. It's some sort of two-year-old consciousness.
Humorist and actor Spalding Gray has been my guest. He's featured in the films The Killing Fields and True Stories. Six of his autobiographical monologues are collected in his new book, Sex and Death to the Age 14, published by Vintage. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. The engineer for this edition was Audrey Voblaitis. Fresh Air is edited by associate producer Amy Sallet. Danny Miller and I produce the show. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks a lot for listening.
National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible in part with funds provided by Philadelphia-based Cigna Corporation, a provider of insurance and related financial services to businesses and individuals worldwide. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.